It's not enough to go beyond the personal for these folks. It's a complete and total grift. And the question is whether the left will figure out how to take advantage of it and actually win some elections. Unfortunately, I remain very skeptical that the left actually knows what to do with this. We'll talk about what the left could do with this on an upcoming show. If you have ideas, certainly let me know. I have some, but always interested in hearing from you. Hey, this is really funny. We have a voicemail number. The number is 219-2-DAVID-P. The other day on one of my live streams, one of our viewers pointed out, you know, Omicron can be has an anagram, which is moronic. I don't know what the meaning of that was, but the guy, Eric from Mass, who told me that, wanted it to mean that we just shouldn't even pay attention to Omicron. Fine. Today's caller found an even more pernicious anagram. Take a listen to this.
David, sir, this is Corey from Indianapolis.
Yes.
I saw on your live stream last week, I think it was a super chat, mentioned that Omicron is an anagram for moronic.
It's Omicron, not Omicron, but yes.
I realized something far more sinister, which is that the word Delta Omicron is an anagram for media control.
Right.
So I think this might go a little deeper than we previously thought.
Yes, and I checked it out for myself. It's Delta Omicron, not Delta Omicron, but it is a perfect anagram for media control. What it actually means, I couldn't tell you, but at least conceptually, some very suspicious stuff going on. We have a great bonus show for you today. Become a member, folks. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Become a member, and you'll get instant
access. WRCT, In Sound, from Way Out.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me. For all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me. For all the best, The smoothest of the smooth. The cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
For those of you.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
There is only one legitimate option now, which is that the case is closed and that Julian is immediately released.
A British court has ruled in favor of the U.S. government's appeal to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to face criminal charges in the United States. Supporters warn his extradition would be a major blow to press freedom worldwide. We'll get an update and look at what's next. Then two journalists accept the Nobel Peace Prize today, Russian reporter Dmitry Muratov and Filipina journalist Maria Ressa.
I stand before you, a representative of every journalist around the world who is forced to sacrifice so much to hold the line, to stay true to our values and mission, to bring you the truth and hold power to account.
Then, The Forever Prisoner, a new film by Alex Gibney, tells the story of how the U.S. treatment of Guantanamo prisoners may amount to war crimes, especially in the case of Abu Zubaydah.
In 2002, FBI and CIA agents thought they had nabbed a diabolical al-Qaeda mastermind. Abu Zubaydah has never been charged with a crime. He was imprisoned in the secret CIA unit called Strawberry Fields. As in, forever.
All that and more, coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A British court has ruled in favor of the U.S. government's appeal to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to face criminal charges in the United States. A London district judge had previously ruled Assange should not be extradited because he would likely die by suicide in a U.S. prison. UK Judge Timothy Holroyd said he was satisfied with a pledge from the United States that Assange would not be held in a maximum security prison in Colorado. Outside the court, supporters rallied for Assange's release, warning his extradition would be a major blow to press freedom worldwide. We'll have the latest on Assange's case after headlines, speaking with one of his lawyers as well as his brother. This comes 2 days after Secretary of State Antony Blinken addressed the White House's virtual summit for democracy, where he announced U.S. efforts to support independent journalism and reporters targeted for their work. On Thursday, President Joe Biden welcomed Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido to the Democracy Summit rather than Venezuela's democratically elected president, Nicolas Maduro.
We are convinced that we can save democracy and therefore save Venezuela, something that the bad guys are winning, but I think it is exactly the opposite.
The Biden administration continues to recognize Guaido as Venezuela's leader. That's despite his involvement in a failed coup attempt in 2019, his failed bid in 2020 to storm parliament with a group of lawmakers in order to forcefully swear himself in as Venezuela's leader. Guaido was also linked to a failed coup plot in 2020 led by Venezuelan dissidents and American mercenary company. A federal appeals court has rejected former President Trump's attempts to keep White House documents secret from the House committee investigating the January 6 assault on the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob. The ruling sets up an emergency review at the Supreme Court, which will weigh whether President Biden had the authority to waive Trump's claims of executive privilege. On Thursday, the January 6th Select Committee released slides from an internal White House PowerPoint presentation that argued then-President Trump should declare a national security emergency in order to delay certification of the results of the 2020 election. The 38-page presentation concluded, quote, "Trump wins." This all comes as the New York Times reports Attorney General Letitia James may soon subpoena Trump to testify under oath in a civil fraud investigation. Separately, Letitia James announced Thursday she's pulled out of the New York governor's race in order to focus on her investigations, which could include a criminal probe, does include a criminal probe of Donald Trump. Here in the United States, at least four states have called in the National Guard to assist overwhelmed doctors and nurses after a post-Thanksgiving surge in COVID-19 cases led to a 15% jump in hospitalizations in just 2 weeks. Nearly all U.S. cases are linked to the Delta coronavirus variant, though health officials warn the Omicron variant continues to spread rapidly. On Thursday, federal regulators approved booster doses of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines for 16 and 17-year-olds. The World Health Organization warned Thursday the Omicron variant continues to spread rapidly worldwide. In South Africa, coronavirus infections are up by more than 250% in a week, nearly all of them Omicron cases. And the United Kingdom's Health Security Agency said Thursday Omicron appears to be outcompeting Delta and is likely to become the dominant variant in Britain. Kate O'Brien, the head of the WHO's Department of Immunization, warned rich countries against hoarding vaccines in response to the new variant.
Head into whatever the Omicron situation is going to be, there is risk that the global supply is again going to revert to high-income countries hoarding vaccine.
A warning to our audience, this story contains disturbing footage and descriptions. In Chiapas, Mexico, at least 54 people were killed and over 100 injured Thursday when a truck carrying migrants overturned. Most of the victims were people from Central America. Witnesses described a horrific scene after the trailer fell on its side, split open, and spilled bodies onto the pavement. The crash came the same week the Biden administration restarted and expanded the Trump-era Remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers, and after the U.S. and Mexico agreed to crack down on migrant caravans. Advocates say the policies have forced migrants to take on more dangerous and clandestine routes to reach the U.S. border. Filipino journalist Jesus Jess Malabanan was shot dead Wednesday by unknown assailants. 58-year-old Malabanan reported for a number of outlets, including Reuters, where he worked on their coverage of Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte's deadly war on drugs. The reporting won a 2018 Pulitzer Prize. Rights groups say dangers facing journalists have increased under Duterte. The National Union of Journalists of the Philippines found 21 media workers have been killed since he took office. This comes as the noted Filipina journalist Maria Ressa accepted the Nobel Peace Prize today in Oslo. Later in the broadcast, we'll play part of her acceptance speech. Police in Daytona Beach, Florida, say they've thwarted a gunman's plans to carry out a mass shooting at the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. On Thursday, police announced the arrest of 19-year-old John Higgins, who was carrying a backpack containing a collapsible semi-automatic rifle, ammunition, and several magazines, including one loaded with 32 bullets. Police Chief Jakari Young says officers were alerted to the plot after two students reported Snapchat group messages they received from Higgins.
He referenced Columbine. He said once he was done at that firing range, he was going to campus to enact a Columbine. By the grace of God, those two students came forward and thwarted that plan.
In a historic workers' victory, Employees at a Starbucks store in Buffalo, New York, have voted to unionize. The Elmwood Starbucks is the first among the coffee chain's 9,000 U.S. locations to form a union. Workers cheered as the results of their vote were announced. 19 employees voted in favor and 8 against forming a union. The union drive and Starbucks union busting attempts garnered nationwide attention and drew support from labor advocates, including Senator Bernie Sanders. Lexi Rizzo, a shift supervisor at the newly unionized shop, spoke at a Sanders town hall earlier this week.
Seen the price of our health insurance go up and coverage go down every single year. I've seen partners be denied maternity leave because they just were not getting scheduled enough hours to be eligible. I don't agree that if we are unhappy with the way Starbucks is, that we should just leave. I believe that when you love something, you fight to make it better. And that's what we're trying to do with our union campaign.
A union vote failed at a second Buffalo Starbucks location, and a third election at the Buffalo Airport Starbucks has not yet been confirmed after nearly half of the yes votes were challenged. The National Labor Relations Board will now review those votes. A court in Texas has ruled against part of the state's near-total ban on abortions, but stopped short of issuing an injunction that would block its enforcement. The law, known as SB 8, allows private citizens anywhere in the United States to sue health care workers and others for facilitating an abortion in Texas. Those who succeed win a $10,000 bounty. A state judge in Austin ruled Thursday the law violates the Texas Constitution, but will allow the law to remain in effect while proponents appeal the ruling. Meanwhile, reproductive justice advocates hope to make California a sanctuary for people seeking an abortion as the Supreme Court weighs a major case which could lead to the overturning of Roe v. Wade. A coalition of over 40 groups are urging California lawmakers to expand reproductive health services ahead of the court's ruling, which is expected by summer 2022. This is Jody Hicks of Planned Parenthood, California.
Guttmacher Institute did a report that predicts a 3,000% increase in people that will find California as their closest clinic should Roe v. Wade be overturned.
If the Supreme Court overturns Roe, more than 24 states are expected to move ahead with abortion bans. In Chicago, a jury found actor Jussie Smollett guilty of falsely reporting a hate crime. Smollett was arrested in 2019 and accused of lying to the police about suffering a violent, homophobic, and racist attack. During Smollett's trial, two brothers, who were personal acquaintances of the former Empire actor, testified he paid them $3,500 for the staged attack and instructed them to place a noose over his neck while shouting lines like, quote, "This is MAGA country." Smollett faces up to 3 years in prison. He was released on bond and his lawyers vowed to appeal. Here in New York City, environmental and human rights lawyer Steve Donziger has been sent home under a pandemic-related early release program to serve the rest of his six-month prison sentence from his apartment. Donziger was sentenced in October for contempt of court after a corporate prosecutor tied to the oil and gas industry went after him for successfully taking on Chevron on behalf of indigenous groups in the Ecuadorian Amazon whose land and water were contaminated by the oil giant. International rights groups and a number of U.S. lawmakers, including Congressmembers Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib, have called for his release. Donziger, who had already spent over 2 years under house arrest before his prison sentence, vowed to continue fighting for his freedom and to hold Chevron accountable for its crimes. And New Zealand proposed new laws to outlaw the sale of cigarettes to upcoming generations and dramatically curtail the availability of tobacco. New Zealand Associate Health Minister Aisha Viral expects the laws will begin rolling out in 2024.
We are legislating for a smoke-free generation by making it an offence to sell or supply tobacco products to those aged 14 when the law comes into effect. As they age, they and future generations will never legally be able to purchase tobacco because the truth is there is no safe age to start smoking.
More than 11% of New Zealanders over the age of 15 smoke, but that rate reaches nearly 30% among the indigenous Maori population. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange could soon face criminal charges in the United States after a UK court ruled this morning in favor of the US government's appeal to extradite him. Assange faces up to 175 years in prison in the United States under the Espionage Act for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Assange has been jailed in England for 2.5 years. Before that, he spent over 7 years in exile in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. There, he had been granted political asylum. A London district judge had ruled in January that Assange should not be extradited because it would be oppressive due to his mental health and that he would likely die by suicide in a U.S. prison. But in a ruling issued this morning, British judge Timothy Holroyd said he was satisfied with a pledge from the United States that Assange would not be held in a so-called ADX maximum security prison in Colorado. According to court documents, the U.S. won its appeal to extradite Assange due to, quote, four assurances sent in a diplomatic note in February, which include the condition that, quote, the United States retains the power to designate Mr. Assange to ADX in the event that, after entry of this assurance, he was to commit any future act that then meant he met the test for such designation. Outside the court, supporters rallied for Assange's release. This is Christophe Deloire, Secretary General of Reporters Without Borders.
We do defend Julian Assange because he's prosecuted for his contribution to journalism. Yes. And his extradition would clearly have long-standing and severe implications regarding press freedom all over the world, in this country, in the U.S., and beyond. Yep. And that's why there is only one legitimate option now, which is that the case is closed and that Julian is immediately released. Yep. And I take the opportunity to call on the journalists everywhere to be totally conscious of what happens now, of what is now considered. It's really the crucial moment for all journalists everywhere to defend journalism, to defend Julian in this case. So really, act now, act before it's too late.
The British court's ruling comes as the Biden administration's hosting a global summit for democracy, where Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced U.S. efforts to support independent journalism and reporters targeted for their work.
We're asking governments to make concrete commitments to strengthen free, independent media and help tackle the diverse challenges that they face. We're increasing protection for the free press here at home. In July, the Department of Justice adopted a new policy to stop using subpoenas, warrants, and other investigative powers to obtain notes, work products, or other information from journalists engaged in news-gathering activities.
For more, we're joined by Gabriel Shipton, who is Julian Assange's brother and a filmmaker, and Ben Wisner, director of the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, also the legal advisor to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Jeff, let's begin, Ben Wisner, let's begin with you. Your response to the ruling by the High Court in Britain.
Well, obviously, anything that brings Julian Assange one step closer to a courtroom in the United States is a terrible step. But it's important to note that only one issue was at stake in the appeal today, and that was the judge's earlier ruling that Julian Assange should not be extradited because of the oppressive conditions of confinement that he would be exposed to that would present a suicide risk. What was not at stake in this appeal is the much more significant legal issue for global press freedom, and that is, can charges under the U.S. Espionage Act result in the extradition of a foreign publisher for publishing truthful information? And this is the issue that really journalists around the world should be watching more closely, and journalists in the United States in particular should be a lot louder about, because whatever they may think about WikiLeaks and however they may want to choose to define themselves in contrast to WikiLeaks, this is a precedent that is going to affect every investigative journalist in the United States.
And let me get the response of Gabriel Shipton. You are Julian Assange's brother. You're a filmmaker. We've had you on before with your father talking about this case. Your response to this breaking news that Julian Assange could be now sent to the United States, though there are still a few other legal steps that have to happen.
Yeah, well, I don't think we can ignore any longer that, you know, we can rely on the British courts to stop this extradition. The charges against Julian need to be dropped by the Biden administration and the Merrick Garland DOJ here in the US. I mean, Julian, he's been, you know, it's been 11 years since he was first arrested in the UK. You know, this is going to be his third Christmas in Belmarsh maximum security prison. He's only been held in Belmarsh at the request of the US DOJ. He is not serving a sentence. The DOJ has, you know, they're requesting that bail is not given to Julian. So really what needs to happen now is the Biden administration needs to drop these charges and let Julian go.
Can you talk about the five appeal points that were heard in this case, how Julian is right now in Britain, and what you think would happen if he were brought to the United States?
Well, I think the appeal was approved on based on the assurances given by the U.S. These assurances have been found. You know, Amnesty International has said they're not worth the paper they're printed on. If he's extradited here, I'm sure they can't guarantee his safety in the US prison system. He will likely die here, if not beforehand. So that's really, we live in fear of that happening to Julian. And as I said, it's his third Christmas in Belmarsh prison now. You know, the conditions there, you know, they're not good there either. He should be at home with his family. He's just, you know, he's being crushed basically. It's hard to put into words really, you know, what we're seeing happening, you know, to Julian. He is so strong and so resilient, but this whole process has really taken its toll on him.
Go ahead.
So the next stage, so Julian has now 2 weeks to appeal this decision. The High Court has ordered the Magistrates Court to approve the extradition and send it to Priti Patel to approve. So Julian has 2 weeks to appeal this decision, and we're going to keep fighting. We're going to appeal, and there is also a cross-appeal in the works which will appeal all the substantive press freedom issues as well.
I mean, I'm looking at the Amnesty statement, Gabriel, and it says, they say, we guarantee that he won't be held in a maximum security facility and he will not be subjected to special administrative measures. Those are called SAMs. And he will get health care. But if he does something we don't like, we reserve the right to not guarantee him. We reserve the right to put him in a maximum security facility, Gabriel.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, these are the person who makes these decisions is the director of the CIA. And so, you know, in September, we saw an expose by Yahoo News investigative journalists that found there were plots within the CIA to kidnap, to murder Julian. So really, what he has been put, his health and well-being, and he's been put in the hands of these people who had plots to murder and kidnap him. So these assurances, like I said, they're not worth the paper they're printed on. They're not assurances at all. And I think you can see what's happened with whistleblower Daniel Hale. He's been put in what's called CMU, Communication Management Unit, which is, you know, it's almost worse than ADX Florence. So there's all these options that they have, that the prison system has at their disposal to restrict Julian's communication, to restrict his ability to communicate with other people in the prison and just really to grind him down to dust, basically.
Ben Wisner, we're about to play the Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech of Maria Ressa. She and the Russian journalist Muratov got their awards today as the Nobel Committee in Oslo talked about celebrating freedom of expression. You're deeply concerned about this issue with Julian Assange. Is he the first publisher to face espionage charges like this in the United States? And what are the plans ACLU has signed on to letters? What are the campaigns planned right now as this process moves forward? And if you could specifically address what Julian released, this whole issue of the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, and decades of State Department communiques and memos, what this information has meant for journalism in the United States, for the United States and the world talking about what happens on the ground in war.
So that's a lot, but I'll do my best. Amy, first of all, yes, this is the first time in the 100-year ignominious history of the U.S. Espionage Act, which was passed during an earlier Red Scare, that someone has been prosecuted with felony charges for publishing truthful information. We've never seen a case like this. This was a Rubicon that we didn't want to see crossed. The Obama administration considered making Julian Assange the first person charged, convened a criminal grand jury, but at the end, cooler heads prevailed, and they realized that there was simply no way to distinguish the conduct that they would have to charge in this case from what investigative journalists at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Yorker do on a daily basis. And let's remember, this case involves disclosures from 2010, 2011, that Chelsea Manning was convicted for providing to WikiLeaks. This was not something that WikiLeaks published on its own. WikiLeaks partnered with the New York Times, with Der Spiegel, with The Guardian, and those newspapers published award-winning journalism covering war crimes that the U.S. and U.K. military had committed in Iraq and in Afghanistan, diplomatic cables that shed light on our support for oppressive regimes and torture and contributed to the Arab Spring. So this was really vital information that the public around the world had a right and a need to know. And here's our concern. At the U.S. level, this indictment criminalizes investigative journalism. Now, the Justice Department wants to say this isn't journalism. This is a criminal conspiracy. He conspired with Chelsea Manning, tried to urge her, cajole her, help her to turn over U.S. government secrets. But that precisely describes what our best investigative journalists do. You could describe everything they do as a criminal conspiracy because they're trying to persuade people with access to privileged and important information to violate the law and turn it over to journalists in the public interest. So this precedent, if there is a conviction here, will chill journalists. Now, it doesn't mean that the New York Times will be prosecuted the next day, but it means their lawyers will tell their journalists that they can't publish important things because of that threat of prosecution. But there's another element here that I think ties more to the global press freedom issue, and it is ironic that it's happening on the same day that these Nobel Prizes are being awarded. And that is that the U.S. is taking the position that our secrecy laws apply criminally to foreign publishers, that someone who has no ties to the United States, who is publishing overseas, making his own determinations of public interest considerations, can be hauled into, extradited, and hauled into a U.S. court and prosecuted. And think about what that precedent will mean around the world. If every regime now can point to us and say, we want to extradite these journalists. Viktor Orban wants to extradite Guardian journalists to Hungary because they published Hungarian secrets. You know, the Chinese want to extradite New York Times journalists because they published Chinese secrets, which the New York Times does routinely. And again, the threat is not that the U.S. will have to send its journalists to China. It will never do that, but that we are now embracing and blessing and setting this precedent that is going to empower the worst authoritarian forces around the world. So look, I take what Gabriel says. I think we are still hoping that the UK courts will find a way to resolve this case without setting the precedent that a foreign publisher can be extradited to the United States. If that doesn't happen, it will be all hands on deck in the U.S. You know, of course, we'll be appealing again to the Merrick Garland Justice Department to find some kind of face-saving resolution here that doesn't involve setting this kind of precedent that will smear their own reputations. And if that doesn't happen, all of these groups will be in court as friends of the court, arguing strenuously that this is an intolerable prosecution under the First Amendment.
Ben Wisner, we want to thank you for being with us, director of the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project. We also want to thank Gabriel Shipton, Julian Assange's brother and filmmaker. To see all our interviews with Julian Assange, including the ones where we went inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he was in political exile before being sent to the Belmarsh maximum security prison, go to democracynow.org. Next up, two journalists have just received the Nobel Peace Prize today in Oslo. You will hear the speech of Filipina journalist Maria Ressa. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. The Nobel Peace Prizes were awarded today during a ceremony in Oslo, Norway, on the 50th anniversary of when Dr. Martin Luther King came to Oslo to accept the Nobel Peace Prize.
I accept the Nobel Prize for Peace at a moment when 22 million Negroes of the United States are engaged in a creative battle to end the long night of racial injustice. I accept this award on behalf of a civil rights movement which is moving with determination and a majestic scorn for risk and danger to establish a reign of freedom and a rule of justice.
That's Dr. Martin Luther King accepting the Nobel Peace Prize. Today, the 2021 Nobel Peace Prize laureates, Filipina journalist Maria Ressa and Russian reporter Dmitry Muratov, accepted their awards during a ceremony in Oslo for, quote, their efforts to safeguard freedom of expression, which is a precondition for democracy and lasting peace. The other 2021 laureates in medicine, physics, chemistry, literature, and economics all received their diplomas and medals in their home countries and gave their Nobel lectures online. This is Maria Ressa's Nobel Prize acceptance speech, which was just delivered in Oslo as we went to air.
Your Majesties, Your Royal Highnesses, distinguished members of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Your Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I stand before you, a representative of every journalist around the world who is forced to sacrifice so much to hold the line, to stay true to our values and mission, to bring you the truth and hold power to account. I remember the brutal dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi, the assassination of Daphne Caruana Galizia in Malta. My friend, Luz Meli Reyes in Venezuela, Roman Protasevic in Belarus, whose plane was literally hijacked so he could be arrested. Jimmy Lai, languishing in a Hong Kong prison. Sunny Shui, who after getting out of more than 7 years in jail, started another news group and now is forced to flee Myanmar. And in my own country, 23-year-old Frenchy May Cumpio, still in prison after nearly 2 years, and just 36 hours ago, the news that my former colleague, Jess Malabanan, was killed with a bullet to his head. There are so many to thank, for keeping us safer and working. The Hold the Line coalition of more than 80 global groups defending press freedom and the human rights groups that help us shine the light. There are costs for you as well. At least 63 lawyers, more lawyers have been killed than journalists in the Philippines. At least 63 compared to the 22 journalists murdered after President Rodrigo Duterte took office in 2016. Since then, Karapatan, a member of our Courage on Human Rights Coalition, has had 16 people killed, and Senator Laila de Lima, because she demanded accountability, is serving her fifth year in jail. Or ABS-CBN, our largest broadcaster, a newsroom that I once led, which last year lost its franchise to operate. I helped create a startup, Rappler, turning 10 years old in January. We're getting old. Our attempt to put together two sides of the same coin that shows everything wrong with our world today. The absence of law and democratic vision for the 21st century. That coin represents our information ecosystem, which determines everything else about our world. Journalists, that's one side, the old gatekeepers. The other is technology, with its godlike power, the new gatekeepers. It has allowed the virus of lies to infect each of us, pitting us against each other, bringing out our fears, anger, hate, and setting the stage for the rise of authoritarians and dictators around the world. Our greatest need today is to transform that hate and violence, the toxic sludge that's coursing through our information ecosystem, prioritized by American internet companies that make more money by spreading that hate and triggering the worst in us. Okay, well, that just means we have to work harder. You know, in order to be the good, we have to believe there is good in the world. Right? An old T-shirt from Rappler from 2014. I've been a journalist for more than 35 years. I've worked in conflict zones and war zones in Asia, reported on hundreds of disasters. And while I've seen so much bad, I've also documented so much good when people who have nothing offer you what they have. Part of how we at Rappler have survived the last 5 years of government attacks is because of the kindness of strangers. And the reason they help despite the danger is because they want to, with little expectation of anything in return. This is the best of who we are, the part of our humanity that makes miracles happen. This is what we lose in a world of fear and violence. You've heard that the last time a working journalist was given this award was in 1936, awarded in 1935. He was supposed to come and get it in 1936. Carl von Ossietzky never made it to Oslo because he languished in a Nazi concentration camp. So we're here. Hopefully a little bit ahead, we are both here. By giving this to journalists today, thank you. The Nobel Committee is signaling a similar historical moment, another existential point for democracy. Dimitri and I are lucky because we can speak to you now, yay, for court approvals. But there are so many more journalists persecuted in the shadows with neither exposure nor support, and governments are doubling down with impunity. The accelerant is technology, when creative destruction takes new meaning. You've heard from David, we are standing on the rubble of the world that was, and we must have the foresight and courage to imagine what might happen if we don't act now, and instead, please, create the world as it should be, more compassionate, more equal, more sustainable. To do that, please ask yourself the same question we at Rappler had to confront 5 years ago. What are you willing to sacrifice for the truth? I'll tell you how I lived my way into the answer in 3 points. First, my context and how these attacks shaped me. Second, by the problem we all face. And finally, finding the solution, because we must. In less than 2 years, the Philippine government filed 10 arrest warrants against me. I've had to post bail 10 times just to do my job. Last year, I and a former colleague were convicted of cyber libel for a story we published 8 years earlier at a time the law we allegedly violated didn't even exist. All told, the charges I faced could send me to jail for about 100 years. But the more I was attacked for my journalism, the more resolute I became. I had firsthand evidence of abuse of power. What was meant to intimidate me and Rappler only strengthened us. At the core of journalism is a code of honor, and mine is layered on different worlds, from how I grew up, the golden rule, what's right and wrong, from college and the honor code I learned there, and my time as a reporter, and the code of standards and ethics I learned and helped write. Add to that the Filipino idea of utang na loob, literally the debt from within. At its best, it's a system of paying it forward. Truth and ethical honor intersected like an arrow into this moment where hate, lies, and divisiveness thrive. As only the 18th woman to receive this prize, I need to tell you how gendered disinformation is a new threat and is taking a significant toll on the mental health and physical safety of women, girls, trans, and LGBTQ people all around the world. Women journalists are at the epicenter of risk. This pandemic of misogyny and hatred needs to be tackled now. Even there, though, we can find strength. After all, you don't really know who you are until you're forced to fight for it. Now, let me pull out so we're clear about the problem we all face and how we got here. The attacks against us in Rappler began 5 years ago when we demanded an end to impunity on two fronts: Rodrigo Duterte's drug war and Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook. Today, it has only gotten worse, and Silicon Valley sins came home to roost in the United States on January 6th with mob violence on Capitol Hill. What happens on social media doesn't stay on social media. Online violence is real-world violence. Social media is a deadly game for power and money. What Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism, extracting our private lives for outsized corporate gain, our personal experiences sucked into a database, organized by AI, then sold to the highest bidder. Highly profitable micro-targeting operations are engineered to structurally undermine human will. I've repeatedly called it a behavior modification system in which we are all Pavlov's dogs, experimented on in real time with disastrous consequences in countries like mine, Myanmar, India, Sri Lanka, so many more. These destructive corporations have siphoned money away from news organizations, and now they pose a foundational threat to markets and elections. Facebook is the world's largest distributor of news, and yet studies have shown that lies laced with anger and hate spread faster and further than facts. These American companies controlling our global information ecosystem are biased against facts, biased against journalists. They are, by design, dividing us and radicalizing us. I've said this repeatedly over the last 5 years. Without facts, you can't have truth. Without truth, you can't have trust. Without trust, we have no shared reality, no democracy, and it becomes impossible to deal with the existential problems of our times. Climate, coronavirus, now the battle for truth. When I first was arrested in 2019, the officer said, "Ma'am, trabaho lang po." "Ma'am, I'm only doing my job." Then he lowered his voice to almost a whisper as he read my Miranda rights. He was really uncomfortable, and I almost felt sorry for him, except he was arresting me because I'm a journalist. This officer was a tool of power, an example of how a good man can turn evil and how great atrocities happen. Hannah Arendt wrote about the banality of evil when describing men who carried out the orders of Hitler, how career-oriented bureaucrats can act without conscience because they justify what they're doing because they're only following orders. This is how a nation and the world loses its soul. You have to know what values you're fighting for. You have to draw the lines early. But if you haven't done so, please do it now. Where on this side you're good, this side you're evil. Some governments may be lost causes. And if you're working in tech, I'm talking to you. How can you have election integrity if you don't have integrity of facts? That's the problem facing countries with elections next year. Among them, Brazil, Hungary, France, the United States, and my Philippines, where we are at a do-or-die moment with presidential elections on May 9th. 35 years after the People Power Revolt ousted Ferdinand Marcos and forced his family into exile, his son, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., is the front runner for president. And he has built an extensive disinformation network on social media, which Rappler exposed in 2019. It's literally changing history in front of our eyes. To show how disinformation is both a local and global problem, take the Chinese information operations taken down by Facebook in September 2020, a year ago. It was creating fake accounts using AI-generated photos for the U.S. elections, polishing the image of the Marcoses in the Philippines, campaigning for the daughter of Duterte, of President Duterte, and attacking me and Rappler, Chinese information operations. So what are we going to do? An invisible atom bomb has exploded in our information ecosystem, and the world must act as it did after Hiroshima. Like that time, we need to create new institutions like the United Nations and new codes stating our values, like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to prevent humanity from doing its worst. It's an arms race in our information ecosystem. To stop that requires a multilateral approach that all of us must be part of. It begins by restoring facts. We need information ecosystems that live and die by facts. We do this by shifting social priorities to rebuild journalism for the 21st century while regulating and outlawing the surveillance economics that profit from hate and lies. We need to help independent journalism survive. First, by giving greater protection to journalists and standing up against states which target journalists. Then we need to address the advertising model of journalism. This is part of the reason that I agreed to co-chair the International Fund for Public Interest Media, which is trying to raise money from overseas development assistance funds. Right now, while journalists are under attack on every front, only 0.3% of ODA funds is spent on journalism. If we nudge that to just 1%, we can raise $1 billion a year for news organizations. That will be crucial for the Global South. Journalists must embrace technology. That's why, with the help of Google News Initiative, Rappler rolled out a new platform 2 weeks ago designed to build communities of action. It won't be as viral as what the tech platforms built, but the North Star is not profit alone. It is facts, truth, and trust. Now for legislation. Thanks to the EU for taking leadership with its Democracy Action Plan. For the US,
reform or revoke Section 230, the law that treats social media platforms like utilities. It's not a comprehensive solution, but it gets the ball rolling. Because these platforms put their thumbs on the scale of distribution. So while the public debate is here, down here on content moderation downstream, the real sleight of hand happens further upstream, where algorithms of amplification, algorithms of distribution have been programmed by humans with coded bias. Their editorial agenda is profit-driven, carried out by machines at scale. The impact is global, with cheap armies on social media rolling back democracy, tearing it down in 81 countries around the world. That impunity must stop. Democracy has become a woman-to-woman, man-to-man defense of our values. We're at a sliding door moment where we can continue down the path we're on and descend further into fascism. Or we can choose to fight for a better world. To do that, please ask yourself, what are you willing to sacrifice for the truth? I didn't know if I was going to be here today. Every day, I live with the real threat of spending the rest of my life in jail because I'm a journalist. When I go home, I have no idea what the future holds. But it's worth the risk. The destruction has already happened. Now it's time to build, to create the world we want. So please, with me, just close your eyes for just a moment and imagine the world as it should be. A world of peace, trust, and empathy. Bringing out the best that we can be. Open your eyes. Now go. We have to make it happen. Please, let's hold the line together. Thank you.
That's Filipina journalist Maria Ressa, accepting the Nobel Peace Prize today in Oslo, Norway, along with Russian reporter Dmitry Muratov. Next up, The Forever Prisoner. We'll speak with director Alex Gibney in 30 seconds.
As time draws near, my dearest dear, when you and I must part, how little you know of the grief and woe in my poor aching heart. It's what I suffer for your sake. You're the one.
Black as Crow by Rhiannon Giddens with Francesco Tirisi. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at one of the last 39 people still imprisoned at Guantanamo, nearly two decades after the start of the so-called war on terror. This week, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing about closing Guantanamo, the first hearing on the issue in 8 years. The Biden administration declined to send a witness to testify and has so far failed to outline a clear plan and timeline for Guantanamo's closure. Since it opened in 2002, Guantanamo prisoners have detailed rampant torture and other horrific treatment while in U.S. custody, conditions many say amount to human rights violations and war crimes. One of them is Abu Zubaydah, whose story is featured in the new HBO documentary film, The Forever Prisoner. This is the trailer.
In 2002, FBI and CIA agents thought they had nabbed a diabolical al-Qaeda mastermind. Abu Zubaydah has never been charged with a crime. He was imprisoned in the secret CIA unit called Strawberry Fields. As in, forever.
Prior to 9/11, CIA never captured or detained anybody.
They weren't prepared.
People started looking for who was best to interrogate, and there weren't any.
Psychologist James Mitchell was the only candidate considered.
I just took it for granted that they knew what they were doing.
CIA officers were certain he was holding back because he wasn't telling them what they wanted to hear.
Something more aggressive had to be done.
The lawyer's philosophy is, tell me what you want to do, boss, and I'll make it legal.
We asked him to draw what was done to him.
Abu Zubaydah is put in isolation.
Everything that was happening was Mitchell's experiment. Nudity has been approved. Sleep deprivation has been approved. Noise has been approved. The same song again and again and again.
Spent 11 days in a coffin-shaped box. He was on the waterboard.
I mean, this is crazy.
The best evidence of what happened is the video.
What was the reason why you thought that it was important to have the tapes destroyed?
I needed to protect the people who were there.
Destroying evidence would inevitably lead to accusations of a cover-up.
It would make the CIA look bad.
It was an impossible story to tell, so I sued the CIA to get materials unredacted.
We saw constant manipulation by the CIA, misleading Bush, misleading Obama.
If my boss tells me it's legal, if the president approved it, I'm not going to get into what some journalist thinks about it.
In America, we have this thing called innocent until proven guilty.
We were the leaders of the effort against cruel and unusual punishment. After 9/11, that's out the window.
Do the ends always justify the means? Are we prepared to abandon our principles in order to defend them?
The Forever Prisoner, directed by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Alex Gibney, who joins us now for more. His other films include the Oscar-winning Taxi to the Dark Side, about an innocent taxi driver in Afghanistan who was tortured and killed at Bagram Air Force Base in 2002. Alex, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you just lay out for us who Abu Zubaydah is, why you chose to make your latest film about who you call the Forever Prisoner?
Abu Zubaydah was a high-value detainee who was captured in Pakistan in March 2002. But the most important thing about Abu Zubaydah was he was the patient zero for the CIA's torture program. He was the first one put through their program of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, or EITs, which include radical sleep deprivation and also waterboarding, what most of the world knows as torture.
So this is the story also of the internal fights between the FBI and the CIA. I mean, the chilling detainment and torture of Abu Zubaydah. First, he's being questioned by the FBI, then moved into CIA custody, led by a psychologist. Explain.
Yeah, so when he was first captured, he was interrogated by two FBI agents, Ali Soufan and a man named Steve Gowden, and immediately they were getting good, actionable intelligence, so potent, indeed, that CIA Director George Tenet was thrilled until he found out that there were FBI agents doing the interrogation instead of CIA agents, which you would think, what difference does it make so long as you're getting the information? But he moved very quickly, George Tenet did, to try to put CIA operatives on the ground to do something different, a more brutal interrogation program, which was initially experimented on and then over time was codified into law by Bush administration officials. That's what happened.
Let me go to a clip from The Forever Prisoner, where we hear James Mitchell, the retired Air Force psychologist and chief architect of the CIA's torture program.
You call this guy Boris. Is Boris his real name?
No. I cannot talk about him, and I cannot even mention his real name.
This is Boris. His real name is James Mitchell.
James Mitchell is the person who's on the image on the screen. The significance of psychologists being involved with what they call enhanced interrogation technique, which is so clearly outright torture.
That's right. I mean, he was a psychologist who worked for something called the Air Force Sears School, which was designed to prepare some of our own soldiers for the depredations of authoritarian regimes, people who might torture us. He tried to retrofit those resistance techniques into interrogation techniques, which was really both a nonsensical thing but also an offense, in my view, against the psychological profession.
Mm. Well, we're going to do part two of this conversation at democracynow.org. Alex Gibney, Academy Award-winning filmmaker, his new film, The Forever Prisoner, is now on HBO. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Wearing a mask is an act of love.
To be a victim of a vehicle theft, but an alarming number of drivers are leaving themselves vulnerable. Keys and fobs are being left in unattended vehicles, making it easier for thieves to hop in and take off. This is especially true in winter months when owners leave their vehicles running to keep them warm. Don't make it easy for thieves. Lock your vehicle, set the alarm, and take all keys or fobs with you. Never leave a car unlocked and running. If you know something about a vehicle theft, call us at 1-800-TELL-NICB. A public service message from the National Insurance Crime Bureau.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh. Guess what? We have gotten to that part in the week, that slot where we do a thing called the mock. My name is Paul. I am the mockster. Before I get to the mock, just before I get too excited and just go sidetrack on the mock, let me tell you that Attic Records joins you in supporting WRCT. Attic Records, they're located in Millvale, and they're open 7 days a week, and they're family-owned and operated, and they provide new and used records and CDs from metal to reggae, hip-hop to doo-wop, and all stops in between. They pay for quality used records and CDs. No collection too big, no collection too small. Again, that's Attic Records in Millvale. You can call them at 412-821-8484. Now, I got to tell you, after my program recently, social media blew up and said, why is the mockster not doing a Nirvana mock? I need a Nirvana mock. So my aged millennials or my very young Gen Xers, or I guess you're some of those middle-aged Gen Xers too, where Nirvana made that impact on them. They're just like, mockster, why are you letting me down? And I thought, well, I've done a Nirvana mock already. So I don't want to do a Nirvana mock. But then I thought, I haven't done an actual mock of Nirvana's Nevermind album. The entire album, track for track, mocking. So that's what I'm doing for you for this program. In fact, I'm going to start off with a cover that came out literally within a year of Nevermind being released. The very first cover, I believe, of a Nirvana song from Nevermind was done by Tori Amos.
Load up on guns, bring your friends, it's fun to lose, and to pretend she's overboard and self-assured. Oh no, I know a dirty word.
Hello, hello, hello.
I feel stupid.